Welcome to Insight, the podcast where we explore the creative solutions achieved by associations navigating today's turbulent landscapes and the people who lead them. I'm Donna Oser, President and CEO of the Michigan Society of Association Executives, host of the show.
Hello, everyone. I'm Ariel Backus, CMP, CTA, Director of Sales, National Accounts for Choose Lansing, and guest co-host of Insight. Choose Lansing is the proud sponsor of this episode of Insight. Whether you're hosting an event for 5 or 500, you can be certain that when you choose Lansing, you can plan on something greater.
Ariel, I would be remiss if I did not congratulate you on your promotion. That's very exciting.
Thank you so much.
I'm not surprised that you're just on your way up. No doubt about it. You're a shooting star. Can you believe we're already recording episode number 3?
Time flies when you're having fun. I'm looking forward to this episode. So at our house, we're celebrating all things Dr. Seuss this week, with March being National Reading Month. I'm excited to chat with our guest of this episode, Debbie McCoola, who is the Executive Director of the Michigan Library Association. Welcome, Debbie, and thank you for joining us on Insight.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to share my views and celebrate with you on the Reading Month this year.
Yeah, it's great timing. So Debbie, let's get right into it, if you don't mind. So tell us a little bit about the Michigan Library Association. Who are your members and how large is your staff team?
So we are a 134-year-old nonprofit membership organization. We serve about 2,500 librarians, library workers, trustees, anyone who works in or for our public, school, academic, tribal, business libraries across the entire state of Michigan. And our work is to advocate on their behalf and to educate them to the highest standards, and then to engage them within the organization.
Debbie, you mentioned that you made the move to MLA late in your career in previous conversations. How has this decision at this point in your career impacted your leadership and approach to the work that you do with MLA?
That's a funny story. And my mother is still, my 85, 90-year-old mother now is still teasing me about changing careers at age 60. I thought I was on a roll to say, I've got 10 more good years in me to really put my stamp on a new organization and an organization and institution that I've never worked with before. So I come from an arts and cultural background, and libraries were not in my purview at age 60 when I made the move. But I think that what has happened, this has been the most challenging position I have ever had in my entire career. And I get to mold and shape and use all of the things that I did wrong, all of the things I do right, all of the things that I thought, oh, I'll do that someday. Everything has come into play within this organization, and I love every second of it, but it is one of the most challenging positions I've ever had. So I get to take all of the good, all of the bad, all of the lessons learned, and really put it into place for hopefully another few years before real retirement happens.
You're doing a great job, and the passion that you have for the work comes through loud and clear when you talk about it. So you mentioned that you, of course, libraries weren't really on your radar previous to this position. So one of the things that I like to dial in these conversations is to get a handle on, so how did you get the lay of the land? How do you listen to your members? How do you find out what their issues are? Talk to us about strategies that you've used to learn more about the industry or profession that you serve and then what that looks like.
Yeah, the funny thing about a couple of organizations that I've worked with, I love to read history, right? I love to read about what an organization has done, how it's come through its hard times. Again, this is a 133-year-old organization, and I was thinking, okay, I'm going to go in and it's going to be like an archive of all of this great information. And I walked into my office and there was nothing in my files. And I was like, oh, where's all the stuff? I need all of the stuff. I need to know what's going on. And of course, it had been digitized, but I'm like, okay, I guess that's where I need to look. But I think I will always start with where has the organization come from and where is it presently? And then through conversations and site visits and road trips around the state, I got to know the individuals that are running these libraries and some of the staff members that are a big part of how a library operates. But I started from scratch. I literally, in all of my years, I walk into a library and the front desk person who checks out my books is a librarian. And that is not the case. And I am not a librarian. So I'm coming at an industry where I know very little about how they are funded, how their operations go. And they're a different animal than what I'm used to from an arts organization standpoint, which are nonprofit, ticketed events. So it was a new kind of learning curve for me. But I think that my board is one of the most supportive organizations. The board is all librarians from across the state, but they're not as familiar with a nonprofit organization. We both learn from each other in terms of how we come at certain things. And I think, truthfully, I bring a pretty creative and a passionate and an enthusiasm that sometimes probably overwhelms a lot of people in the library world. But I think that's the only way I know how to do my work. And I'm excited about just being able to grab onto something that I learned from another organization or from being from a theater background or having an arts background and can bring something very creative into the fold about how to advocate and how to communicate and how to celebrate an organization that is as old as it is.
That's awesome, Debbie. Thanks for sharing. Could you explain to us about how libraries receive their funding?
Sure. So there's three pots of money that public libraries, I'll stick with public libraries because that's probably what I know best. Public libraries are funded primarily through millages. So they are locally controlled and locally funded. Anywhere between 75% and 95% of their funding comes from voters in their community saying, I want to support our library. Another pot of dollars comes from state aid to libraries, so government funding from the general fund. It's about $15 million. And so if you think about, we have 397 library systems throughout the state. There's about 650 buildings in those systems. So that doesn't go very far. So that's about maybe 2 to 3, maybe up to 5% of their funding. And then the third pot is a weird pot of funding, which comes from penal fines. And penal fines are somebody speeds or a truck didn't go through the weigh station and they are fined. And the penal fine then goes to something good, which are the libraries. And it is constitutionally based. If you read the state constitution for Michigan, somewhere in that document, they have identified libraries as receiving penal fines in perpetuity at this point. So those are the three main categories. There's some fundraising going on with friends groups, selling of old books and things like that, and the used book sales. But I'm going to say the majority, 99.8% of their funding comes from those three areas.
But it sounds like that in itself was probably a deep dive when you first got the position, getting your arms around how your members' institutions are funded. And there's some complexity to that. Now, interesting. So you mentioned that share that portion of funding is going to come from those penal fines, which is in the Constitution, which means that the folks who wrote that Constitution believed that libraries were providing such an essential service to the public that they wanted to provide for that. One of the things that I believe about associations is that associations are actually doing work on behalf of their members that ultimately changes the world, changes the quality of our lives, particularly in the United States. So my next question aligns directly with that. So when you think about the folks that you serve through the Library Association, how are they changing the world? Tell us a little bit about that.
I'll say that I think that they evolve with the world. So when we see new trends happening, or if a community lets go of a service and it's still needed within that community, I think a library is one of the first places that understands that. They're empathetic to who's walking through their doors. They're one of the last public institutions in our community. So think about the other institutions, the post office, maybe the Secretary of State. and our libraries. Those are the three big institutions that are publicly funded and are accessible for no cost. So you can walk into any of those places, but do you really want to spend time at the Secretary of State or the... So our libraries have turned into social centers. They are community centers within the broad spectrum of that, and obviously have places to read and places to study and places to learn, but they're also providing the kinds of services that a community requests. And that's really important. So if a community, we're looking at communities that are moving away from providing a lot of social services, they're moving away from being customer oriented, and our libraries are picking up slack. Where can you go to get free copies or to scan materials or to get free Wi-Fi or to have a study room available to you if you are an entrepreneur and need a space to connect by Zoom to for business? They are providing tax help. They are providing programs to learn more about the community and about things that we might not know about. Maybe it's astronomy. Maybe tomorrow there's a story walk. But they're providing those things because the community has requested it. Somebody in the community has requested it. They continue to evolve to provide for the wants and the needs of those individuals. A couple of new things that are happening in the library world is one is makerspaces. So there's not enough, and from an art standpoint, I'm like all ears. Oh, this is great. Learn how to weld, learn how to do 3D printers. They have that equipment. It's available for use. And a lot of them have hired individuals that know how to run all of those, that can train and to do all of that work free, right? And the other thing is the library of things. So libraries are not just books any longer. They are places to go find if you're looking for a new tool and you don't want to go to, you know, a store and purchase, you know, a very expensive whatever. I don't, you know, I'm not a tool person, but you go to the library. Many of them have tools. They have ladders. They have kayaks. They have pie pans. They have puzzles and games and all sorts of things that you wouldn't recognize in a library these days. But I walked into mine the other day and hanging from the rack are some cake pans. I was like, what are you doing with cake pans? What's that about? They were like, how many times have you gone out and bought a Winnie the Pooh cake pan for your two-year-old, and then you bake once, and then you have that in your cupboard for the next 25 years before you end up getting rid of it? So you can come and get it for a one-time use, bring it back clean, and we're going to hang it back up and allow somebody else to use it as well. So they're just being very innovative with, again, they're places of information and places of access and places that lend anything and everything complimentary to anybody in the community. And everyone in the community has immediate access. Out of the 10 million people in the state of Michigan, 5 million have their library cards. That's a pretty big number. And while you may not use your library, I think that you would be surprised that it doesn't look anything similar to what you remember as a child. So encouraging you all to go visit your local library and see what's new.
I had no idea. And I love that you can find so many different things at your local library. It's amazing.
Planning an event can be challenging. You need to choose the proper meeting space, the right accommodations, best dates, and keep everything within budget. The expert team of certified meeting professionals at Choose Lansing will ensure you have everything you need for a memorable event. Complimentary services range from venue and hotel referrals, custom planning and promotions, to on-site assistance. They will help you shine so you can host the best event yet. The choice is easy. Choose Lansing and plan on something greater. Learn more at lansing.org.
When you walk into the library, you see so many generations. You see very young children and older generations. I'm shifting over to the recruiting end for libraries. How is recruiting going for libraries? And are you finding that library careers are attracting a lot of young people?
I don't know if I've ever even looked at that from a patron standpoint. We certainly serve the very young to the very old. when it comes to who's running the library and who's working at the libraries, we have two wonderful schools here in Michigan that offer master's program in library sciences, University of Michigan and Wayne State. And they are continually moving students up through the ranks and into the library world. So I think we still have a really good resource in those two universities to keep popping out those who are coming into the field and wanting to be librarians, whether it's public libraries or school librarians or academic librarians. It just depends on what your interest is. They're all three very different animals. And I think that those two schools are, again, they're making sure that we have enough talent to push into these positions. I think we're also seeing a revolving door. When the pandemic hit, we saw a lot of retirements. And then we see this circle game happen. Okay, this one's leaving, so I'm going to take that job. And then this one leaves, and then I'm going to take that job. And then, so it's just this kind of big circle, and then it stops for a little while. But we're seeing a lot of new directors in the state of Michigan. Again, we have, there's 397 library systems, and we're seeing a lot of new directors. We're seeing a lot of new talent come in. We're seeing people rise up from within their organizations to the director's position. I'll take one good example is we saw the director of the Ferndale District Library move over to the directorship over at the Capital Area District Library here in Lansing. And the assistant director, there was no search. There was no doubt of succession planning in their organization. And they moved their assistant director up immediately. So there wasn't even like a 2-minute pause in who they knew was going to be a part of that organization and directing the administration and the operations of it. So I think we're seeing a lot of internal talent pop to the surface. And then I also think that people are, they're always exploring. I want to work at a different kind of library. I want to work in a rural area, a small library, or I want to work in the biggest of libraries. We've got Detroit and the Kent District Library over in the Grand Rapids area and Ann Arbor. Those are really big systems with multiple locations. If you want to work in that kind of environment, you have choices to be, there's choices to be had.
Yeah, lots of really interesting opportunities. And we think about from a workforce perspective, purpose-driven work attracts so many more people today. And certainly the work of libraries is definitely purpose-driven. We think about how they're serving communities, diverse communities, and making literacy and just experimentation, right? That spirit of inquiry available to folks who otherwise it might not be available for. And one other thing I was thinking about that when you were talking about the Library of Things, and we had a conversation the other day about people think of libraries just in terms of books, but really it's so much more. But in the fullness of it, all of those possibilities, but a time where we're really trying to take a look at our consumption and be responsible and not create more waste than we want to, it's another great reason for folks to engage with their local library. Because of that notion of just not buying more than you need, right? And sharing with others. Usually you only read one book at a time. Maybe sometimes I find myself with more than one, but that's another story. All right. So I wanted to circle back, Debbie, if you don't mind, to something that you mentioned earlier. We were talking about how did you get dialed in and how do you, you know, stay connected to your members? And you talked about how you have developed relationships and you've done a lot as far as getting on the road and getting out there and meeting people. So one of the issues that caught my eye in the last couple of years for you is this notion of the right to read. And so I was hoping that you'd talk a bit about how that rose to the surface for you as the leader of a state association and how you geared up your association to respond to your members' needs. And then, of course, some of the subsequent outcomes of the work that you've been doing.
This is the My Right to Read, MI. So if anybody's looking for it, it's at mirighttoread.com. We recognized probably 2.5 years ago, we're members of a national organization and you know we're watching our sister organizations in other states, just as other associations probably do. There's 50 of us. And we have listservs and we talk to each other. And it's really interesting because we were seeing this unprecedented volume of challenges to books and materials, mostly with, you know, history or LGBTQ rights, right? Or authors or topics, race. We were seeing a lot of these being challenged in our schools and in our public libraries. And we were just seeing, I know there's a border between Ohio and Michigan, but that's not going to stop someone from bringing it to Michigan. And we were seeing, we were starting to see some of our communities starting to deal with challenges. And some of them were very informal. I had some complaints. Some of them were much more formal. They were filling out, you know, a request for reconsideration. All libraries have to have a policy on what their collection development policy is. How does a community member request that they look at a book and maybe remove it from the shelves if it doesn't, you know, reach the standards that they're looking for? And as that was starting to happen across the country, we began to think about it, of how to react to it if it came to Michigan, and how to do it proactively so that we weren't creating more of a, we didn't want to create this unpartisan environment. We wanted to make sure that everybody recognized that we all have First Amendment rights. We all have the ability to choose books that we want to read, and that nobody really had the right to make a sweeping decision that took that careful consideration away from the reader. So we started the website. It's a website that actually just documented all of the media that we were reading in the state of Michigan and articles that were going out about what community was looking at this. We wanted to make sure we had a proactive stance of how to take action, and whether it was on social media or a letter to the editor or making a presentation that allowed us to be in front of a different audience, a more of a patron audience, more of the citizenship of Michigan, and not just the libraries. And then we wanted to make sure that we had resources for the libraries if they were going to go through a challenge. These are very expensive processes. A lot of attorneys are involved in some of these challenges, and we wanted to make sure that we were supporting our libraries and the trustees and the directors, if it came down to that, and making sure that people knew that everyone has the freedom to read whatever they choose and the right to read. And we're protecting that component. We don't really go into what book you're reading or anything like that. That's very private to each individual. And what my neighbor reads is probably not what I read. So we created this website, and then we created the request form. If you're having an issue, if you want to have an interview, if you need more information, we had a hotline, but the hotline comes directly to me. So, right. And so we were able to respond quickly when there were challenges in a community. There's still things that are happening in our communities. It slowed down a lot, but we're coming up on an election year, and we know that there's a little political football going back and forth a little bit with this. This is low-hanging fruit with everything else that's happening in our country, but we wanted to make sure we had a proactive way to look at this. And from that, once the website was developed and once we started to receive a lot of requests for letters and can you come to my board meeting, we decided that it was probably time to do a full statewide poll. And so we wanted to have a valid, statistically valid poll created with. So we hired a firm. They had 40 questions. We went to 800 voters in the state and found overwhelming majorities that do not believe in censorship, do not believe in book banning. And first question we asked was, do you love your library, or something very similar? And it's 85 to 90% of everybody loves their local library. So we really wanted to make sure we had data to back us up, and we could then use that within our legislative agenda. And from that poll then came an idea to put some state legislation into place, and which is what we're working on right now, that will protect the right to read in our public library. So we're starting with our public libraries first, and puts into play ideas of First Amendment rights and using the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act as the basis for libraries that should be protected. All of those books and those authors should be protected by our Civil Rights Act. We are using that as the basis for some of this legislation.
So let me just do just a couple of quick follow-ups. Sometimes when folks are listening to a podcast, it's, you might be driving or doing something else. I want to reiterate for our listeners that your work is really focused on serving your members, which is a large membership. But in this case, we're talking about public libraries, not K-12 libraries, not what's in our schools. We're really talking about community libraries, just so there's, you know, no confusion about that. And so I like to come at some of this from that digging deep about, because here you are, gosh, at that time, you probably had been exec for maybe 3 years. I'm trying to think of the timing, maybe about 3 years. And at that time, how large was your staff team?
We've always been five. There's five full-time staff members, but I'm the only one that is doing really the advocacy work. I think what we do is we pull everybody together. Everybody knows what's happening, yet we all have very distinct roles within the organization. So advocacy work comes about because of the work I do and the work that we do with our paid lobbyists. So we contract with a multi-firm lobby.
So you've got this staff of five, but you're really the one team member that's leading the charge on this, maybe with some ideas and brainstorming with your fellow staff members. And from a bandwidth perspective, you had a longstanding relationship, I imagine, with your multi-client lobbyist partners. So this is a board conversation that you're going to pursue this, right? And when you talked about this with your board and you made the decision to invest in some additional contracted support for the public relations and outreach side of this, the survey work, tell me about that. Was that a pretty straightforward, it percolated up and it was an easy buy-in, or was that a tough decision with your group?
No, it was one of the easiest decisions I think that they've ever made. And we have, again, because of the age of the organization, we have an investment account that just sits, right? And it's there for our use in case of bad years. Of course, the pandemic caused some issues there. But we had enough in our reserve to be able to step up immediately. Truthfully, the context of that conversation was the no-brainer conversation. If we don't do it now, what are we saving that money for? What would it be used for? And I think that the campaign, the polling, all of the things that went along with the My Right to Read campaign, we started a whole new committee based on, you need to tell me what you want me to do. With only five staff members, and so I'm glad you bring that up, because we are an organization of volunteers. Our 2,500 members, about 200 of them step up every single year. And they're the ones that create the program for our conferences. They're the ones that tell me, so they're in my ear constantly. This is what I need you to do. This is what I want to see happen. And as a small organization, okay, so I can be creative. Once you give it to me, let me run with it, right? So give me everything that you think should be, could be, would be in this big picture. And you're getting multiple opinions, of course, right? But then my job is to mold and shape it into, what way do I get to then push this out? Because I'm not a librarian and I don't have the background, I have to listen to those experts. They are the experts in how a library should be run, should be created, should be operated. And so listening to that part of it. And then the other ear is the lobbyist, of course. This is the political reality of everything. And I think when all of that comes together and I get to be the middle of all of that and to really to mold and shape both sides of the coin, we get some really creative, proactive kinds of things that we're moving toward. But my staff is totally important to all of that because they're the sounding board for me. I'm the sounding board for them when it comes to an event. And then the board and the membership, the lobby firm, the realities of politics, and we find that middle ground. And I think that was a challenge in all of that. That's love the daily, wow, this is like, I got something new to do. I think that when it gets routine, I am not a happy girl. And every day seems different. Every day there's a new challenge. Every day there's something more to listen to and to incorporate. That's when we can do it. I think that's when my right to read started, you're right, about 3 years after. But I've gone through, again, I come from an arts background. Censorship is not new to the arts world either. In the course of my entire career, we've gone through a lot of the more, I will call it more national and federal advocacy work on behalf of censoring artwork and theater productions and things like that. I didn't get to do it as deeply as I am doing it here within the Michigan Library Association, but advocacy to me is not just legislative advocacy. It's really listening and molding and shaping the communications and the how we're going to communicate and how we continue to be that nonpartisan organization, because we are supported by all sides of the coin.
Debbie, this program has proven to be such a success. So can you tell us a little bit about the outcome and what next steps are?
I think the very next step is to get some legislation introduced. We have it written. It's ready to go. We have an advocacy day where we're bringing about 150 librarians to Lansing in the next month, and we're hoping that everything is ready to go and that we can see some success at getting some legislation put into place that protects the right to read. The second part of that is that we have also been recognized here in the state and nationally for the work that we're doing on My Right to Read. We just came off of winning the Michigan Humanities Organizational Award of the Year for the work that we're doing. And we're also recognized on a national basis through our sister organizations, through the American Library Association, in an Intellectual Freedom Award that we're very proud of. We're not after awards. I guess I'll start with that. We're just not after those. But when it comes, it just makes all of us so darn proud of what we have achieved over the course of, again, 2.5 years of really putting almost full-time attention to protecting the right to read and protecting intellectual freedom, that it humbles us about the work that we've done, but it also makes us extremely proud and probably pushes us to the next, like, what's next? We're continuing to look for what is next for us. And if we can get this legislation moving and we can get it passed, we will know that our success has been achieved with the program that we put into place.
Awesome.
Yeah, that's fantastic, Debbie. I want to just wholeheartedly congratulate you and your team and your board for taking on doing the courageous work. Sometimes these things come up and it's hard for associations to sort through how they're going to actually be able to accomplish, especially something as lofty, as aspirational as this particular endeavor has been. Great that you did have the reserves, right, to be able to purchase some additional expertise and bandwidth to move the program forward. So congratulations to all of you. And thank you so much for joining us and sharing a bit today. Hopefully you'll stay in touch and let us know if you're successful at joke in associations. It's often easier to kill legislation or tear apart legislation. It's a very difficult thing to get your own legislation introduced. So we wish you the best of luck in that endeavor.
Thank you so much. It's been enjoyable being here and talking to you both.
We also want to say a huge thank you again to our sponsors at Choose Lansing for their support of this podcast. Be sure to visit our friends at lansing.org for more information.
Thank you to all of our listeners for joining us for today's episode of Insight. You can find more details about the terrific work of MLA and Debbie McCullough in the show notes located at msae.org. We hope you'll subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Until next time.